This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Soccer is a source of national pride in many Latin American countries. And around the world, we celebrate greats like Brazil's Pelé or Argentina's Diego Maradona. But women have been an integral part of soccer in Latin America since its advent, and their stories are often pushed to the side. In the new book, Futbolera, A History of Women and Sports in Latin America, authors Joshua Nadel and Brenda Elsie examine the rich legacy of women in soccer. They also trace women's athletics back to the emergence of physical education programs in the 1800s. Joshua Nadel is an associate professor of history at North Carolina Central University. Welcome back, Josh.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brenda Elsie is an associate professor of history at Hofstra University, also the co-host of the feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down. Hello, Brenda.
Hello.
Brenda, why did we feel the need to write this book?
I think we felt the need to write this book because we both wrote other books in which we didn't focus so much on women. But in the process, we got hints and traces of a really wonderful history that was in there.
Tell us more about that history, Josh. Take us back to the 1800s in Latin America.
Sure. So, I mean, in the late 1800s, you sort of have this trend in Latin America towards nationalizing education programs, and part of that is physical education. And there's this desire to create sort of modern citizens that are sort of loyal to the nation, and women are seen as crucial to that. So women's physical education is seen as sort of one of the focal points, really, of emerging nations in Latin America. To train women to be good mothers, they had to be physically fit in gender-appropriate ways, and that way they would sort of recreate the nation, help to recreate the nation.
I mean, this is interesting, Brenda, because it suggests that people had these ideas, and I guess they did, but now they're going to formalize them in the context of physical education, these ideas about what a woman should look like and what her physique should be in a well-tuned state, right?
Right. Sport is a particularly important place where the state and also non-state actors came together to define what was that ideal body. What is the sort of basis of gender difference? It still happens today with a case like Caster Semenya. Sport is a sort of platform that becomes very important to defining those identities.
And so what were those identities, Brenda? What was a woman supposed to be, and why was her physical health and how was her physical health supposed to be shaped those days?
So at least in the case of physical education programs and in the case of sports clubs, what women were supposed to be was harmonious, attractive, easy to get along with for their husbands, brothers, you know, people. Women were supposed to care very much about their maternal health above all. And exercises were attuned to making sure that they had not too much muscular development, that they were not too stimulated and not understimulated, and that they had very little physical contact.
Yeah, so this is fascinating, the idea that motherhood is central to all of this, and we know how to make a good mother and a good body in preparation for motherhood. What does and does not contribute to that? So where does soccer fit into all this, Josh?
Soccer very much does not fit into all of this. Soccer is seen sort of from the moment that it arrives, that women start playing it is seen as incredibly transgressive, right? It is considered to be a rough sport. It is considered to be something that is too physical for women to play. It goes against their quote-unquote fragile nature. Things like that. I think there's a lot of effort to ridicule women who play soccer in Latin America, and also ultimately limits to ban women who play soccer in Latin America because it is seen as so contrary to what Latin American nations are trying to do, and the type of women they're trying to create.
Brenda, is this coincidental, or is the rise of physical education in the schools also give rise to interest in soccer for women?
One of the interesting things that we found is that in the early part of the 20th century, when most physical education instructors were still women, they developed teams both in schools and beyond schools. So, you know, in a public park, getting together matches with former students, with their colleagues. So it's a really interesting process as women are pushed out of physical education in the teaching profession. You know, by the mid-century and more toward today, and men replace them, we see fewer and fewer instances of that. Also, soccer is written out of the curriculum for women in a much more official way throughout the century. So if anything, it does spark interest, but then it gets actually a sort of more challenging for girls to pursue that.
Well, once they start showing an interest in, and I guess making teams, that's when, you know, the men feel like they've got to start forcing them out. How competitive was this? Was this just young women playing soccer, or was it creating a spectacle? Were there leagues, clubs? Tell us about the early part of the 20th century, Josh.
Sure. I mean, in Brazil, certainly the earliest games were in the 1920s, and the earliest leagues also sort of developed in the late 1920s, early 1930s. In places like Panama, there are leagues in the 1930s as well. Also in Costa Rica, in the 1940s and 50s, there are leagues. And in basically throughout Latin America, there are leagues developing. In the case of Brazil, which is sort of one of the cases that we focus on in the book, you know, the leagues develop to such an extent that this becomes sort of, it's raised to the level of a national crisis by concerned citizens who suggest that allowing women to continue to play football will create, I believe he calls them destructive nuclei of the nation, because women will become infertile, they will lose their interest in men, and they will become basically unhealthy mothers.
Brenda, what causes this at this moment? Is it simply the rise in popularity of the sport? It's suddenly getting everybody's attention, or was there something else going on in Brazil that made people worry about this possibility?
Well, what we found is that the more soccer becomes identified as the national sport and it becomes so very important in social life and defining masculinity and proper masculinity, the further they're pushing women away from it. And that happens at the club level, and then it sort of also happens under the administration of Getúlio Vargas, which is an authoritarian president at that time. And it seems very clear that it's a reaction to feeling threatened by women taking public space and by them sort of trying to fit themselves into representing the nation and representing, you know, their regions, et cetera.
So there's political ideology here, national identity, and all these identity questions that you've just raised. Josh, to what extent is it also a commercial problem? We see women tend to get pushed out of spaces once they become commercially viable.
Sure. I mean, there's definitely, I should say that, so there's this ban that's put in place. Vargas puts a ban in place in 1941. Women continue to play football, or soccer, excuse me, throughout Brazil. And in fact, you know, there is a good deal of concern about the commercial potential of women's soccer. Women teams bring in quite a bit of money when they do play at big stadiums. They're spectacles, and so there is concern on the part of the Brazilian Federation that women will start taking fans away from the men's sport. This also happens later in the 1970s in Mexico. You know, women's soccer becomes incredibly popular for a very brief period of time, but it's basically shut down by the Mexican Federation, largely because of concerns that the game is actually better than the men's game, that women play more honestly than the men, and that there will be some commercial sort of deficit for the men's game.
And interestingly enough, Brenda, we talked about the fact that there was some commercial success. Women, people turned out to watch these games. And in those days, women tended to play for charity. Is that right?
Well, in Brazil, claiming that you were playing for charity was one way to get around the legal ban. And so that becomes a really popular way in which women are able to continue their practice. You know, in other cases, I think, too, women are able to have a little more leeway in claiming some sort of leadership and public space when it's supposedly for charity because it invokes all of those issues about being maternal and taking care and those types of things. And certainly it does assuage the fears that they will somehow hurt the market of the men's game.
And Josh, in the book that you and Brenda have written, Football Era, you talk about this ban imposed in 1941, not ending until the early 1980s, and yet women continued to play. So one way is to say it's a charity. What were some of the other ways that they were able to continue to play? Because they did, right?
They did, in very large numbers. I mean, I think one of the exciting things about the book is that, you know, since it's come out, there's also a lot of new research coming out since we submitted it, let's say, that suggests quite the level of play in Brazil. So one way we've seen is that women's soccer in Brazil continues outside of the major soccer centers. So Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro are sort of the main centers of soccer. So women are playing in the provinces, and there's much less attention by the national sporting bodies there. But we also find that they gained a lot of support from regional sporting bodies and local sporting associations, as well as schools. So, you know, it was seen by many as a great way for women to continue to be physically active. There are some cases. I mean, in fact, there's one team who's the brother of the founder of the team becomes eventually the president of the Brazilian Soccer Federation and is now disgraced. Was sort of caught up in the FIFA scandal.
So obviously the clubs and the associations are taking note. But Brenda, what impact does this have if you're playing out in the provinces as well on just the rise and popularity of soccer in general in that part of the world? Women certainly played an important role and perhaps an understated role in how much soccer gets promoted in that part of the world.
I mean, absolutely. It was so interesting. In the book, we interviewed the captain of the Brazilian team and the Golden Boot winner of the 1999 Women's World Cup 50. And we asked her about what it was like growing up. She's from Bahia. What it was like growing up under the ban. And her response was, you know, I pulled the heads off dolls and played with them as if they were soccer balls and figured, who in the heck was going to look for me here? And that was her attitude toward it. You know, I mean, it is remarkable when you think today that one of the players that will take the field in France is Formiga, who was born during that ban. And in 1978. And so, you know, it's fascinating. It really has, I think, kept alive a tradition of regional women's football, soccer, in the sense that, you know, they were able to escape the worst sort of surveillance.
And you talked about the player that you just mentioned, Cece, rebelling against really the feminine ideal. I mean, not only is she moving this game forward, born during the ban, but she's really been very outspoken about who gets to play and how I get to look and how I get to claim my own identity, right? Tell us more about her. Brenda?
Yes, Cece was very outspoken. She shaved her head for that World Cup, which was a pretty big scandal. She complained about sexual harassment in the federation in the late 90s. And also that even once the ban is lifted, a lot of the federations, like the Sao Paulo Federation, continue to make it a requirement that women have long enough hair to make a ponytail to compete. And so she just leaves. She has to leave and plays for the professional LA Soul in the U.S. and plays out the rest of her career in the United States, which is really, you know, wonderful for U.S. fans, but sad for the fact that she never found a place in Brazil, and many, many of the top talents have never been able to find that home.
Well, these questions of who gets to claim their own identity and our expectations about how women should be in sport go back a long way, Josh. In the 1920s, of course, the women's suffrage movement, it gets to Latin America, the rise of the flapper aesthetic. And this is also tied to the story of women in sports, right?
Sure. I mean, because sport is seen, particularly when it's taken out of the role of, let's say, out of the surveillance of the state, so when it's not in a physical education class in school, the role of sports is seen as it's seen as both modern and so for some sectors of society, that's incredibly dangerous, right? Because they want women to remain in their sort of traditional roles in the home. So with the suffrage movement, with the flappers, with sort of the modern girl movement, if you will, you know, that comes with sport. It comes with a more athletic, both figure, athletic sort of attire. So fashion is changing along with the growth of women's sports. And all of that is seen as incredibly threatening to sort of traditional Latin American societies. You know, at the same time, there are obviously a lot of women who are pushing for this, right? Or who are pushing particularly for collective sports, right? So there is a series of sort of acceptable sports in Latin America at this time and throughout. So tennis is seen as acceptable, swimming, horseback riding, rhythmic gymnastics, all of those are sort of acceptable at the time. But it's the collective sports where there's sort of a space for women to get together and communicate with each other outside of the surveillance of men that are really threatening.
And the other interesting part in all of this, again, is, as Jash points out, the idea of the threatening sport is the one where we can get together and be outside the surveillance and the control of the state. But the paradox this raises, too, is one that you raise in your book, Brenda, which is, you know, sports can be a kind of mainstreaming arena for marginalized populations. Look, we can do it, too. We can play your game, which means sometimes you have to play the game all the way. And so homophobia plays an important part in the critique of women in soccer, the idea, you know, prevalent among critics that if these women are playing sports, they must be gay. And so women would have to push against that and only now are saying, well, no, wait a minute, we can come out and claim any identity we want. I mean, talk about that paradox and that journey, Brenda.
Yeah, it's so often something that women describe as feeling physically liberatory to play, and yet the institutions are so very often repressive, particularly of sexual identity. In the case of women's football, whether it's in Chile or in Brazil or in Mexico, the authorities that be have a constant implication that there's something wrong with these women for wanting to play, that it indicates that they are going to be or already are, you know, sort of masculinized and their femininity is questioned. And really, today, there's no out Brazilian women player. There's just recently a couple of Mexican ones. So this is a struggle that continues today. And, you know, part of marketing and demanding that women market themselves, particularly based upon their sexual attractiveness and heteronormativity, is a central part of this. So not anymore will the soccer institutions that be say outrightly, or very few of them, there are still some, will say outrightly, you know, yes, being gay is a problem and playing football means you're gay or playing soccer means you're gay. However, what they'll do is say, you really need to market yourself. And there's codes for that and ways in which they really enforce it through informal ways.
So, Josh, tell us more about how then the game is being received, the women's game is being received today.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of very positive things going on in the women's game in Latin America today. And I think we could also sort of say broadly around the world, this is not just a Latin America issue. I mean, we can look at the United States and sort of look at equal pay issues and also look at the way that the women's team is marketed and who tends to be marketing the U.S. women's team. Just that's a small aside. But I think, you know, there are a lot of positive things coming out in Latin America today. I mean, there's, you know, the Mexican League has had there's been a professional Mexican women's league for about 3 years now. There's, you know, collective action on the part of Argentine players in order to, first they went on strike in order to get the pay that they were supposed to receive for being on the national team. And then recently there's been the creation of a professional league there. In Chile, you have the creation of a union and sort of an increased awareness of rights. At the same time, you still have a number of problems, I think, in the region. I mean, what Brenda was just alluding to, about 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, one of the a vice president of a Colombian team on the, you know, national news show or being interviewed after a game went on and said that women's soccer is actually a cauldron of lesbianism. And this was in, you know, this is a vice president of a club that has a men's team and a women's team. So those attitudes sort of still exist. I think, generally speaking, I'd like to say that there's more of a, you know, this much more of a positive trend, but there's still sort of people who will do what they can to hold the sport back.
Joshua Nadel and Brenda Elzey, the co-authors of Football Era, A History of Women and Sports in Latin America. Josh is an associate professor of history at North Carolina Central University. Brenda's an associate professor of history at Hofstra University and the co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Josh and Brenda are going to be talking about their book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Tuesday, June 18th at 7 o'clock. We've got it at our website, stateofthings.org. Josh, Brenda, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the North Carolina Museum of History honors the work and stories of women who quilt. It's a new exhibit, and we'll talk about it in just a moment. Stay tuned.